Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. I'm your host, Gary McGraw, CTO of Cigital and author of Software Security. This podcast series is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine, where a portion of this interview will appear in print. For more, see www.computer.org/security and www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is the 38th in a series of interviews with security gurus, and I'm pleased to have with me here today, Kay Connolly. Hi, Kay.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Kay Connolly is an associate professor of computer science at Indiana University. She's also senior associate director of the IU Center for Applied Cybersecurity Research. Kay's research focuses on user acceptance of ubiquitous and mobile computing, where there's a delicate balance between such factors as convenience, control, and privacy. She holds a PhD in computer science from the University of Illinois. In addition to being a Silver Bullet victim, Kay has also been interviewed by NPR. Kay lives with three men in Bloomington, Indiana, two of whom are her boys. So first off, congrats on your recent tenure promotion.
Thank you.
I suppose you can say most anything you want now.
I'll try not to, though.
Watch out, world.
Yes.
So let's dig into the past a little bit. You won a Best Paper Award at UbiComp in September 2007 for some work on usability. And I wanted to ask you, why is watching how people actually use technology outside the lab important?
Well, especially when you're talking about pervasive or ubiquitous computing, we're no longer talking about going up to a computer, a PC, for example, and doing a very specific task that's very self-contained. And that's where usability labs really are quite useful, looking to make sure a particular interface is constructed in such a way that people don't make very many errors. But now that we're taking technology into the real world and people are oftentimes interacting with the technology without even realizing it, you really have to have the technology situated in the real world to know how it's going to be used.
Does that kind of cut against the grain of what most people thought?
No, I think that the community as a whole is going in that direction, but there's a lot of difficulty in deciding when is it okay to use the usability lab and when do you have to do in-situ evaluation. Mm-hmm. Because, quite frankly, it's very time-consuming and expensive to deploy these things for any period of time. And so when you can get away with the usability lab, you certainly want to.
I think sometimes when people gain a lot of expertise in any particular subfield, they start glossing over some of those things. And there's a disconnect that comes about when experts think about technology versus when real people think about it. And so I think maybe it's an evidence of that. And I wanted to know if you think that that disconnect is exhibited in privacy work.
Absolutely. I think that if you look at a lot of the privacy literature, and the way that people define privacy, it's very academic. Mm-hmm. You know, you have all these different, you know, privacy as property, privacy as autonomy. And that's not the way that people talk about it.
How do people talk about it?
It's different for everyone, quite frankly. And it turns out that people actually talk about it in terms of what they're trying to do. Privacy isn't what they don't discuss privacy necessarily, but are they able to do what they want to do? And privacy is kind of a side effect that they don't necessarily think about.
So if we boiled it down to a simpler question, like, do people think privacy is what experts think privacy is? The answer would be...
I would say no.
No.
Absolutely not.
That's pretty interesting.
I mean, there are certainly different aspects that do resonate with people. I've worked a lot with elders and trying to understand what their concerns are with putting technologies in their homes that are meant to allow them to live independently for longer. Mm-hmm. And they do talk about Big Brother, and they talk about not wanting people to always have a window into their home. Mm-hmm. But when we try to figure out, do they think about this as property, or do they think about this in terms of autonomy, it's very different for different individuals. And a lot of it does boil down to, is the particular system we're presenting something they find very useful, mm-hmm. something that they think is going to help them? And if it is, then they may accept deep sea invasion more than if it's something that they just can't get their heads around and they don't understand why they would want to use it in the first place.
So it's very much a context-sensitive trade-off.
It's very context-sensitive, and that's one of our major findings is we can't really use the whole Weston-Harris classification of how people are in terms of privacy. It's very dependent on the individual and the particular context.
Can you explain the Weston-Harris thing? Because I don't know what you're talking about.
There's this survey that was really done to determine, how much information people are willing to give up kind of in business context, like if you go on the web or something like that, and you get classified as... there's a range from...
Probably from Twitter all the way to...
Well, it was made a long time ago, before Twitter. But you have all the way from where you're very concerned about privacy to where you don't care about privacy.
Right, with the Twitter people being on the end that doesn't care.
Absolutely. But as it turns out, that really didn't apply for the group that we were looking at. Different people were concerned about different systems and different aspects of the system. And so we could not give them a classification and said, this person is going to care, so we need to make sure we don't gather any data like X.
Mm-hmm.
You just couldn't do that. People are too dynamic and too individual. And oftentimes, a lot of what came out with the elders is, I wouldn't want this now, but later when I'm facing this particular issue, it would be okay.
Right.
And so it's going to change as they age.
That's tricky.
It's so, very tricky.
So I got a follow-up on that one. You've won some important awards for your teaching, including the Trustees Teaching Award, which is very prestigious.
Thank you.
But how do you teach about privacy? I mean, this is hard enough to talk about. How do you teach about it?
Well, I have not taught a privacy course, I should say, but I have certainly embed privacy concepts in my pervasive computing course, which is a graduate level course. And the way that I teach that in general is you have to get out there and actually try to design and build these things with real users. And privacy comes up in that context. People will tell them if something is not making them comfortable.
Mm-hmm.
But it certainly is a challenge to discuss, I think, privacy. And there's no right answer, I guess. Is the hardest thing in a class. Students are going to have different perspectives. And so the biggest thing I do in my classes is there's a lot of discussion. And I've had a student come out and say, privacy is a dead issue. We don't care about it. Everyone's going to know everything about everyone.
The Scott McNeely approach.
Right. But it's a really good thing to have the class discuss and have, some people are going to immediately, go against that idea and just have them actually discuss and come to some sort of a consensus of what the issues are, not necessarily what the answers are.
Right. I got into computer science from philosophy to avoid all that.
Well, it's back. I think that computing in general is becoming much more intertwined with these other areas. I mean, psychology and social science and healthcare. We're having to know a little bit about all of those things because computing is affecting all parts of our life anymore.
So here's a toughie. Does your teaching inform your research more than your research informs your teaching?
I would say that they really go pretty much hand in hand, especially for my graduate level courses. I always bring in a current research project, and that is their semester-long project. So I'll usually have six groups in a course, team-based projects, and probably two of those will end up going on and becoming full-fledged research projects.
Mm-hmm. I listened to your NPR interview the other day on the polite cell phone thing.
Yes.
And I kind of marveled at the naivete of some of the other researchers in the story because they want the convenience of having the device know everything about them. And it seems to me as just an unbelievable invasion of privacy that people are just somehow blind to. Do you think most people are blind to that, or is it just researchers?
I think both. I think you certainly have individuals who are very privacy sensitive and they won't use things like the loyalty cards
mm-hmm.
Because they don't want corporations knowing everything that they purchase.
Mm-hmm.
But those are few and far between. I think we've found that if there is some sort of a utility, people are pretty willing to give up their privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Because, for one, they really don't have a good concept of how all of this data can be aggregated somehow used against them. And that's one of the things that we're doing with the elders now, because we found they really didn't understand what some of the threat models were towards their privacy. So we're, especially when we're talking about newer technologies and they might not understand how the technology would be used in their home, because it's very different than what they're used to. So we're actually developing video skits where we really make these kinds of threats clear. So if you're talking about, you know, internet shopping, there can be price discrimination based on your past history. And they don't realize that. But once it's made clear, then they become very concerned. So there's a lot of education that needs to go on about what people can do with this information.
You know, my college roommate was aware of the data aggregation risk, but he thought it would allow him to get better junk mail. So he was cool with the whole thing.
But in some ways, that's true, right? When you're on Amazon and they suggest books that you might like, and they hit it a lot of times.
It's because they know everything you've ever bought.
Yes. So there are certainly trade-offs.
Unfortunately, they believe that I'm a big Nintendo DS player because my kids use my Amazon account.
We actually have an Amazon account for my eldest son so he can have his own wish list.
There you go. Otherwise, you get these crazy suggestions. So you're like, wait a minute, I'm not 13. What's up?
Absolutely. But we're very concerned about him being involved in other aspects of the internet. He doesn't have his own email account that he checks on his own. He doesn't have Facebook and things like that.
Yeah, John Stewart and I talked about that in an episode way earlier in Silver Bullet. He's the CSO of Cisco. And his kids are slightly older than ours, so it was interesting to hear what decisions he's made. We'll be right back after this message. Hi, this is Gary McGraw, host of the Reality Check podcast with Gary McGraw. This podcast series is focused on practical questions centered on running large-scale software security initiatives. Reality Check targets experienced leaders working to solve software security problems every day. Reality Check is sponsored by Sigital and syndicated by CSO Magazine. For more, see www.sigital.com/realitycheck. So everybody's heard of HIPAA, though few can describe in concrete terms what it may or may not have done for them, besides get a piece of paper when you go to the doctor.
Right.
So is government regulation of privacy a good or bad idea?
Well, I actually think that it can be a good idea. If you look at the way that it's done in Europe, for example, and you basically own data that is about you, and people cannot collect data for one reason and then go use it for another reason without your consent, I think that that is a very good thing. Although there are some problems now with businesses actually being able to be productive under that model. But certainly that's better, I think, than over here, where when data is collected about us, except in the medical realm, people can use it for whatever they want, so they can use it for other purposes later.
Another way of putting it is your data doesn't belong to you.
Absolutely, and I think that that's really bad. I think that the government does have a role in those types of things. I think the problem with HIPAA is that it's a lot of regulation that wasn't necessarily thought out really well. So what it results in is basically you signing away, you know, your control of the data in order to get your insurance reimbursed. And certainly it's not complete, right? I mean, no, you couldn't go into my doctor's and try to get that information without doing some sort of a scheme, you know, to trick them out of it.
Putting on a dress like some Monty Python.
Right. but certainly, I have no idea who has access to that information, because who all needs it in order for me to get insurance reimbursements.
So what do you think the best way to impose privacy progress on recalcitrant corporations is?
Well, I think that you actually have to have laws saying that they cannot use the data for reasons that they didn't get your permission for. And then those laws have to be enforced. Right now, it's whatever they put in their privacy statement, which can change at any time without your notification, by the way. And so it means absolutely nothing.
Do you know Annie Anton?
I do not know her. I know of her.
Yeah, Annie was a previous victim in Silver Bullet, and she said that, you know, if you read those privacy statements, they actually don't actually follow them most of the time.
Right.
So it's kind of like what we wish our privacy statement was, or our policy was. So you talked a little bit about your focus on elders and technology, and I think that's a good thing to talk about next. The Ethos Living Lab that you guys have built is extremely cool. I've had the opportunity to go wander around in there. Will you explain two of your favorite projects from the lab so that people get a feeling for what kind of work you're doing?
Absolutely. Some of them I can't because they're under patent procedures right now. Mm-hmm. But one of my favorite ones is called the Presence Clock. Mm-hmm. And the idea is you have two clocks that are paired over the internet. And one is in the home of the older adult, and one is in someone else's home, most likely an adult child. Mm-hmm. And the clocks have a motion sensor on them so that when someone walks by their clock, it is registered and lights come on the remote clock to demonstrate that someone is near their clock. And so it conveys presence information. Mm-hmm. So for an example of how you would use it, my mom would have hers next to her chair in her sitting room, and I would have mine in my kitchen because we both spend a lot of time in those spaces. Mm-hmm. So when I get up in the morning, I can look and I can see what time my mom started getting up that morning, because maybe at 7 a.m. the light is of moderate intensity. Mm-hmm. And the clock will actually flash if she's currently there. And so I can just kind of get a rhythm of her day that, yes, she's up and she's having her coffee, and then maybe I check in later and I can see that she was sitting there after lunch, and it just allows me to know that she's up and about without me having to call her every morning to make sure that she's okay.
So the non-intrusive nature is what you're looking for?
Very non-intrusive. It goes with what you naturally do. You don't have to do anything to say, I'm okay. You just walk by it as you naturally would. And so it's both a way to tell a little bit about making sure that the person is safe and is okay, because if I see that there's been no activity in the last 12 hours and I didn't know if my mom was supposed to be gone somewhere, then I might pick up the phone and give her a call.
Right.
So it's to make sure she's okay, but it's also to connect us more. You know, a lot of problems with older adults is they become socially isolated. So she can see when I'm in my kitchen, you know, fixing my lunches for my kids and things like that, and it just gives us a sense of security, a feeling that someone is on the other side. And this one's a really interesting project, because when you first introduce it to older adults, most of them don't get it.
I was going to say, they probably say newfangled fancy pants clock.
Absolutely. They say, I'd rather just pick up the phone. But when we actually deployed it, and the people we deployed it with did look at us like we were nuts when we were installing this thing. But after a week of it, they didn't want to give it back.
Right.
They just didn't realize how much a sense of security and connection to their daughter would give them.
Did you let them keep it?
We didn't, because it was really it was not really at a stage where it was going to work
mean,
in the long term.
Mean people.
we would love to. In fact, what we're doing right now, because we're going to be going into four homes of older adults this next year, and that's one of the prototypes we've chosen, and so we are making them more robust so they can be there for several weeks at a time. Mm-hmm. So it will be something that will be available to people we work with in the near future.
That's a cool project.
It's a lot of fun.
Do you have another one you can explain?
Sure. The other one that I would talk about was actually designed by my colleague Jean Camp, and it's called the Portal Monitor. Mm-hmm. And the idea behind this is that whenever someone either rings the doorbell or opens the front door, a series of pictures, quick snapshots, is taken, and it's sent via an SMS text, mm-hmm. A multimedia text, to an adult child or a caregiver, informal caregiver's cell phone. So that if you have an older adult who's alone and you're worried about people preying on them, mm-hmm. in some way, you can get, every time, you just get a little text and you can go through the three pictures, you can see who's there. You can say, oh, that's a neighbor, or, wow, this is someone I don't recognize. Maybe I should give my mom a call and make sure that she's okay.
Hmm. And is that sort of preying on elders becoming more common?
I don't know that it's becoming more common, but it's always existed. You've always heard of, you know, the contractor who convinces the older adult they need a new roof when really they don't.
Right,
and
right.
And so there's a lot of financial fraud that's in person. But also there was kind of a recent one that made the national headlines of a woman who was actually kidnapped. And this could have alerted the authorities a lot sooner about the possible abduction and what the abductor looked like.
Mm-hmm. That's very interesting work. So I guess in your other life, you're committed to forwarding women in science and women in computing as well. So here's an easy one. Why are there so few women in computer science?
Well, that's a question that a lot of people have studied, and we don't have a definitive answer. It's hard to come up with that. But certainly, we do know that there is a problem with image, that when you talk to young children about what does a computer scientist look like, they basically give you that very geeky stereotypical, they have glasses, they work in the front of a computer all day, they're nerdy, and people don't want to be that. Right?
Ryan's pointing at himself.
But so we turn a lot of people away, male and female, who don't want to be the nerd. They don't see themselves as that kind of a person. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of ways, we're not doing a good job saying what all you do as a computing professional.
Right.
So I certainly do program, and I have programming skills, but a lot of what I do is interact with people to figure out what kind of technology would make sense in their everyday lives. So I have a lot of social skills as well.
Mm-hmm. So what advice would you give to a young woman who's interested in pursuing computer science as a career?
It depends on what her interests are. It would be very individual. So I don't have kind of a patent speech on here's how to make it as a woman, mm-hmm. because I don't know. I just don't.
You have a data sample of one.
Well, I actually have about half of the graduate students in my lab are women,
uh-huh.
Which is a very high number for this area. But my work tends to attract a lot of women because it's in the health arena, and it's been shown, research has shown that more often than not, women want to pick professions where they can make a difference in people's lives. And this is very hands-on. You're actually working with, say, dialysis patients or elders or whoever it is, and you can see the impact that you're making. And so I think that I would say to anyone that there's computing and what is now being called informatics is really wide open in terms of what you can combine those computing skills with to do different things. You could, if you're interested in sports, you can do things with sports. If you're interested in biology, there's bioinformatics. So I think that technology is going to become more and more of our lives as academics and researchers and just practitioners in the future, regardless of what field you're interested in. So it's really good to get that foundational knowledge so you can be a bridge person between the people who are only, say, biology and only computer science. You mm-hmm. can be that bridge, and those bridge people are very valuable.
Mm-hmm. That's nicely put. So for the last question, something completely different. The book I'm currently reading is called The Song Is You by the guy who wrote Prague. And I know you share my love of fiction.
Yes.
So what are you currently reading?
I'm actually reading essays from, and I didn't bring it. I'm terrible with authors' names. I was told there would be cake by a young woman who lives in New York City, and I should remember her name because one essay is all about her name.
we'll find it and put a URL.
Okay. And it's just, it's something that I can read in small chunks. With having small children who are going to be over the summer, I can't really get involved in something very long right now.
Right. Well, thanks. This has been fun.
Thank you.
This has been a Silver Bullet Security Podcast with Gary McGraw. Silver Bullet is co-sponsored by Cigital and IEEE Security and Privacy Magazine and syndicated by InformIT. The May-June issue of IEEE Security and Privacy is a special issue on securing online games, edited by me and Ming Chow. The issue includes articles about cheating, virtual economies, the law, and security mechanisms. Don't miss the bonus article online at www.computer.org/security. Show links, notes, and an online discussion can be found on the Silver Bullet webpage at www.cigital.com/silverbullet. This is Gary McGraw.